Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of March 7th. This week we were joined by Elizabeth Lev, who has an article in the current issue of America looking at the de-Christianization of art by certain art historians over the last several centuries. Professor Lev lives in Rome and teaches Christian art and architecture at Duquesne University, as well as the University of St. Thomas Catholic Studies program. I spoke to Professor Lev by phone from Rome.
We're going to talk a bit about your article for America, looking at kind of the history of sacred art and also art history. Maybe we can begin by just looking at, you mentioned some of the kind of major art figures at the start of your article, Michelangelo, Caravaggio, and how they're seen today versus kind of how they were seen in their own day. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, what got me interested in this whole question of the history of art history is the way that these very famous artists, who clearly worked in a very Christian milieu, they work for popes, they work in churches, they work around Jubilee years, somehow have been translated into figures of every possible modern-day political activism or contrary thought process imaginable. Caravaggio always perceived as the bad boy of art, of sort of a rebel who, despite his utter disdain for all things church-related, somehow manages to have a successful career. Michelangelo, who worked for this world that could not, in the words of Bernard Berenson, worked for a world he could not but despise. I mean, this interpretation of how these artists looked at their own world is just, it seems kind of crazy.
And yet, as you say, this has become kind of the standard narrative in many art history textbooks, for example?
Well, it's a very standard narrative in many art history, in many art history classes. Art history textbooks are generally a little bit more restrained in interpreting where where the artist is coming from politically. That's not our job. Our job is to actually learn about the formal aspects of a painting. However, you will find in a great deal of art writing, which supplements the textbook, you'll find in a great deal of art writing, it's just sort of a commonly understood thing that these people are not somehow first person engaged with the religious content of their own work.
Your piece, you do a kind of look at history and see where this came from. So what did you find in terms of looking back at the history of art history?
Well, art history was born as a kind of slightly defective science. Of course, it's not truly a science because we do so much interpretation. There's so much trying to gauge things that we simply cannot measure or weigh. So art history, where this discipline comes from, this understanding of how to look at paintings, is a very strange and a science that's very much a work in progress, or a discipline, I should say, that's a work in progress. So I found that it started with our first art historian is Giorgio Vasari. At least in Western art, our first great art historian of the modern era is Giorgio Vasari, painter and art historian and friend of Michelangelo. And he writes a biography of artists. And he has a whole bunch of things he wants to get across, the role of the artist, the importance of the artist. But we'll find that he is very much part of his own times and that he recognizes the sacred character of art and that an artist must respect and engage with the sacred character of art. However, when art history has its real birth, it's in the Enlightenment period. And we find that the people who are teaching us how to analyze paintings created for churches, liturgical spaces, a private devotion, the people who are teaching us how to look at them are people who do not believe in any of these points, questions, faiths. These same people who are leading us by the hand to look at a painting by Michelangelo do not believe in what he is talking about, and therefore they begin to project their own distance from the subject matter, from the devotional aspect of the subject matter, they project it on the artist. And that's what I found happened in the history of art.
Well, you mentioned Vasari, for example. Maybe we could just look at his take on Michelangelo. He was a friend of Michelangelo versus some kind of later art historians. He's considered him to be, maybe you can just talk a little bit about how he saw his friend Michelangelo.
Vasari saw his friend Michelangelo as a gift from God, in the sense that Michelangelo not only was the greatest living talent with the hand and the eye and the judgment and all the art historical skills you could, all the artistic skills you could possibly want, but all of that was couched and framed by a man who Vasari says, good Christian that he was, studied his scriptures closely. A man who we know now was a third order Franciscan, a man who Giorgio Vasari never drops behind the spiritual importance of Michelangelo's character. As a matter of fact, that's part of his perfection. A good and holy man side by side with a supremely talented man. That's what makes a great artist in the eye of Giorgio Vasari.
And then you have a switch, as you mentioned earlier, in the 18th century to art historians who are more secular in their in looking at people like Michelangelo, and they kind of applied that lens. Is that correct?
Well, it's fascinating, these characters who come up. I mean, they're great historians, and they give us really invaluable steps along the way in understanding and developing a methodology for art history. But you know, Johann Winckelmann, who we call the father of art history, he was a man who converted to Catholicism just to have access to the papal collections. He was originally Protestant. He had actually been raised in a very Protestant family. And he when he came to Rome, realized that the only way his career could advance as if he were indeed Catholic. So his conversion, then his letters up to his friends explaining that, you know, I haven't really turned, but, you know, I need this in order. It's just a piece of paper to him. And so that compromise that he makes in his life soon becomes the way that these art historians see the way artists live their lives. So Michelangelo must have done the same thing. Oh, Caravaggio must have done the same thing. Leonardo, Raphael, Bernini, they all must have done the same thing that I did, without ever realizing, because of this almost vision of this almost inferior intellect of the Catholic. You know how the period that we're talking about coincides with this moment when we begin to see, when the world begins to look upon Catholics as a silly, superstitious people. So how can you put these great talents and intellects like Michelangelo, Raphael, Leonardo, Bernini into a context that's so brilliant? How could they possibly be Catholic? So you have this incredible clashing of the 16th century. The greatest intellectuals are all Catholics, and then we have this 18th century, 19th century vision of the Catholic as a sort of silly, superstitious, ignorant person. And so, in a certain sense, Michelangelo and Raphael must be converted to something not Catholic in order for their art to be read by the non-Catholic audience.
And yet you point out in your piece that at the same time as there was this kind of appropriation of Michelangelo and other artists, the Catholic Church did not come to kind of mount any kind of defense, because they were at the same time kind of growing a little suspicious of some of these artists.
Yes, we are very much to blame for our own situation, I'm afraid. As a matter of fact, when Ludwig von Pastor writes The Lives of the Popes, which, you know, in that tremendous opus of his, of these, you know, I forget how many volumes it is, of The Lives of the Popes, in which he delves into all these lives, and at the end of it, he looks down, he says, you know, the Holy Spirit must have been helping this place along. It must be something divine in this for this to actually still be running. It's actually a profound moment for him to understand the idea of grace in the church, this intensive study. And in through that sense of grace, I mean, a real grace that Pastor feels in his research into the papacy, he transmits that these accomplishments of the Renaissance popes are things to be proud of. And amazingly enough, when he writes this book, it's like a shock. People have become accustomed to being ashamed of the worldliness, what they perceive as the worldliness of the 15th century church, this almost, you know, this skirting of the pagan. They see the numbers of ancient sculptures that were collected. They see the interest in philosophy. They see the interest in these humanistic types, these humanistic themes, and they're suspicious of it. And so instead of defending Michelangelo and Raphael, they feel kind of, well, maybe those guys really cared more about art than faith. Well, maybe those guys really were too involved with these sort of more secular themes. And so they actually take a step back from them. So no, we were not great defenders, and we're not great defenders of our own tradition.
And then later, you have major figures like Freud or Marx, and they became, you know, everything was kind of looked at through those lenses. So, as you point out, they became another lens to look at art history.
The critical juncture is in Jacob Burckhardt, which brings us to the mid-19th century. When Jacob Burckhardt comes along, He is his own personal biography, studied for theology, discovered he doesn't believe in God. He divorces completely from any concept, not even a question of a Catholic faith, a Protestant faith. He simply has no faith. And he, however, loves Italy and loves the Italian art. And so his entire career will be spent studying, for the most part, the art of Italy, which naturally is a sacred art, and finding a way to contextualize it. Now, the thing about Burckhardt, which is, there are many wonderful things about Burckhardt. There are some really, truly great things he gave us. One is a popularization of art. He's the man who actually took photographs, and when he talked about paintings, he showed you photographs. I know it's impossible to imagine a world without this, but, you know, imagine all the art history lectures with no pictures. So he brought art to everyone through photographs. He also gave popular lectures so that everybody would be able. He had a sense of universality of art, that everybody had a right to learn and to know about art. So he gave us some wonderful things. But at the same time, he slanted art with a great deal of subjectivism. His art, his views of art, his ideas of art were profoundly subjective based on his own experience. Once art history is born under this man who talks about the context of the art, and so was born under a very subjective influence, let's say, and so it's very easy after that for art history to be pulled in any direction. So when, you know, this Marxism, this fever for Marxism comes into being, everybody looks at art in this terms of, these downtrodden artists who are, you know, speaking up for the little guys, or the tremendously problematic key of interpretation that Freud gives us, which is a completely self-referential. So the artist is not relating to a greater thing outside himself. The artist is always looking inward, according to Freud, and so we start to get these interpretations of Michelangelo made Mary look young because he misses mommy, or, you know, whatever it's going to be. But it's a very dangerous lens to be looking at sacred art from, because the whole point is just looking outwards or looking through at a greater reality. And Freud teaches us to stop looking outwards and through to a greater reality, but to actually sort of turn our eye inward and basically, you know, navel gaze in front of a painting.
Now, where does that bring us today? I mean, are there art historians kind of looking through both lens, you know, looking through the Christian lens as well as, you know, the Freudian Marxist, or is it mostly the latter? Is it mostly kind of the secular kind of approach?
I would say that when I was studying art, I think the reason why this subject is very dear to me is that when I was studying art, the approach was almost entirely secular. It was an art that was, at least in the United States, and the Italian art history is a completely different story and would require a whole separate article. But generally for Anglophone art history, or which was thoroughly dominated by this German school of thought, Winckelmann, Burckhardt, and the gang, I would say that it was a profoundly, profoundly secular type of art history, to the point where really considerations of faith were not tolerated. That's my very, very vivid memory from my college days when I, you know, a University of Chicago pagan, had, you know, absolutely no idea, but sort of wandered into the idea of a liturgical use. Was this used for something? And was shot down immediately and very abruptly, that was not a way to consider art. So yes, in the, you know, 1980s, we're talking about a very, very secular view of art. There have been some magnificent people doing great work in the modern age, excellent scientists, excellent scholars, but also not refusing to accept, you know, this was taken out on this particular feast day. This is a sermon that was said under this painting. And so these people have really started to drag art history onto a track that just allows the paintings to be more full, more fruitful, to bear more fruit, and to be more beautiful.
So there are people, scholars in the West, as well as you mentioned Italy as being a totally different story, who are trying to kind of rescue the Christian tradition.
There have been some great scholars in rescuing the Christian tradition, or at least not excluding the Christian tradition, and that is a very, I mean, there are people who really do work now actively in recovering the Christian tradition. And there were people, by the way, even in the 19th century. Henri Thode wrote a very interesting thesis on the Franciscans, who would have been the great the Franciscans, who were one of the great impeti of Renaissance art. There's also Emil Mahl, who will do a tremendous amount of interpretive work based on sort of devotional practices in France. So there is this tiny thread. But instead of having their voices drowned out by the Freudians, the Marxists, and everybody else, now these voices, these modern voices, these heirs to these thinkers, are now able to stand side by side and really get their ideas out and have their books published and help us to see art in a more well-rounded way.
You also mentioned that this kind of look at art, kind of at the secular approach, has also had effects on the art itself. This notion of art must be free, and that kind of can be controversial in this country, where sacred art is desecrated, or at least sacred images are used in ways that people find objectionable. So maybe you can talk about that.
Well, the art must be free mantra is a very modern one, and in oddly enough, I study more than anything else. I study the era of the counter-reform, when the era of post-Council of Trent, when there are new dictums and mandates and rules about art, and it's very, very frequently held that was the church trying to strangle art. But out of that, out of this series of rules and suggestions and guidelines, we get Caravaggio, Nibali, Carracci, and Bernini. Instead, in this period of art that must be free, we get people who are just in the search of sensation. We get a Damien Hirst, a Tracy Emin, and very, very frequently, just simply, each artist trying to out-shock the other, whether or not we're talking about, a Damien Hirst shark in formaldehyde, or even, these characters who consider themselves artists who want to be called artists, like a Lady Gaga. This silliness of just pure superficial shock value as opposed to any real substance. And that is what happens when art is free, because what does the artist do besides simply, how much can a single person run on? How much can a single person offer the world? The great art, the art that people stand in line for hours to see in museums, the art that stands the test of time, the art that people in the midst of, war and desecration and you name it, will do anything to save those works of art, are always works of art that lead us out of ourselves. Whether it's a Greek sculpture that shows us the most beautiful human form possible, whether it's the Sistine Chapel that tells us the promise of salvation and the heroism of man, that's the art that lasts, but it looks outwards. And this art must be free, that continues a sort of a self-reflective, I feel this, I feel that, I want this, I want that. It cannot be anything more than just these sort of superficial sensations. And so I think a few guidelines for art might actually produce real art once again.
Now, finally, we would talk briefly about, you're in Rome, you're teaching there, and you mentioned that in Italy the art history is very different from kind of the Anglophone art history. Is it different, too, in terms of just living there and working there, and the fact that a lot of this art is in sacred places? Does that shape the understanding of art in a different way?
Well, absolutely. The in situ, my classes are on site, and the joy of being on site and seeing that a Caravaggio painting has this mysterious source of light coming not from a window but from the direction of the altar, you begin to realize that the artist takes the use of the liturgical space and incorporates it into the art. When Michelangelo paints the Last Judgment in the Sistine Chapel, the entire painting is anchored to the room by the crucifix on the altar. The crucifix, which is a wooden crucifix from 100 years earlier, without it, the painting is incomplete. And so this amazing gift of being able to live here and see these works in their proper places, I think, gives an insight and understanding and a richness to them, which is, it's irreplaceable.
Well, Elizabeth Lev, we want to thank you for taking a few minutes to talk with us.
I'm very happy to talk about this subject. It's something that it fuels my day, so I'm delighted that you wanted to hear more about it.
I want to thank you for joining us for this week's edition of the American Magazine podcast. Reminder to look online for some other features, including a review of the Watson phenomenon, the IBM computer who beat out his human counterparts on the show Jeopardy. And that is by Associate Editor Kevin Clark. We also have an archive of articles by Father Robert Trinan, the late congressman who served in Massachusetts, House of Representatives from Massachusetts for 10 years. And we have a selection of his many articles for the magazine. This is Tim Reedy, for America Magazine.